Okay, so we reconvene our meeting. I believe we're going to talk about leases, right? And who's going to give the presentation? Atsushi. So you wait for me, yes?
Yeah.
Now you can go.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
ではリースのセッションを始めたいと思います。このリースについては我々も何年もずっと一緒に関わってきてますので難しさは非常によく理解しているつもりです。なのでこの夏にその ISB と FSB が、まあ、合意して、まあ、再公開草案に、出せることになったということについては高く評価しているところです。ただこれまでの定期協議でも我々意見を述べてきているように、特にレッサーの会計処理についてはまだ懸念を持っています。なので今日はそのレッサーの会計処理を中心に、議論させてもらいたいと思います。ペーパーの説明は兼ねず。
Yes, I'm sorry.、Yeah.
She one is about lease accounting, and as described in paragraph 7, we continue to support a hybrid approach for lease accounting because we believe the economic substance of lease transactions varies and the pattern of profit recognition should be differentiated based on differences in their substance. However, we have some concerns about the proposed method for distinction between different types of leases.Our primary concern is about whether the proposed method would reflect the economic substance of lease transactions from the viewpoint of revenue recognition. As described in paragraph 10, we think it is necessary to take into consideration the nature of the residual asset as well as the lease transaction itself. This is because we think the lessor's business is performed by leasing its underlying asset to either one or more lessees during the lifetime of the underlying asset and acquiring the residual asset from the lessees. In paragraph 11 to 15, we raise two points for discussion. The first point is a componentization notion included in residual and receivable approach, which is described in paragraph 11 and 12. We think tangible assets, including leased assets, function as a single unit, and in general, these assets' future cash inflows are difficult to disaggregate into more than one component.Therefore, from this perspective, when the lessor retains a certain degree of the risks and rewards incidental to the underlying asset, basically, we think proposed residual and receivable approach would not be appropriate. The second point is described in paragraphs 13 to 15, which is about the volatility of the value of the residual asset. As described in paragraph 11,We do not necessarily agree with the componentization of the underlying asset, but we think if the lessor can reliably estimate the value of the residual asset, the componentization of the underlying asset may be justified. This is because, in this case, revenue recognized on the commencement of the lease is unlikely to be reversed subsequently. However, as described in paragraph 15,In cases where volatility of the value of the residual asset is relatively high, even when the lessee acquires and consumes more than an insignificant portion of the underlying asset, we think it would be inappropriate to recognize day one profit. Accordingly, we do not agree with the proposed tentative method for differentiating between the different types of leases for the lessor.Paragraph 18 to 23 are concerns about the treatment for real estate leases. We understand the argument by some constituents, which is the real estate leases have different characteristics from other leases, such as equipment leases. However, as described in paragraph 19, when considering the scope for practical experience, focusing only the form of the underlying asset would not be appropriate. In addition, we are concerned that the proposed practical experience would be a significant departure from the core principle for differentiating between the different types of leases. In paragraph 24 to 36, we discuss the lessor's accounting from the viewpoint of consistency with revenue recognition project. As described in paragraph 25, in general, there are two types of leases, lessor's obligation in a lease contract. We think every lease has these two performance obligations. The point here is which performance obligation is more important for each lease. For further discussing this point, we put together several types of lease contracts in the table in paragraph 27. Among several types of leases in the table, our focus is on type 3 leases and type 4-1 leases. About type 3 leases, in these leases, the lessor transfers more than an insignificant portion of the underlying asset to the lessee, but retains the substantial asset risk of the residual asset. As described in paragraph 30, these lease transactions are entered into primarily for the purpose of obtaining a return from the active management of the underlying assets rather than providing financing to the lessee. For type 3 leases, we think the obligation to permit the lessee to use underlying asset continuously over the lease term is more important. Accordingly, as mentioned in paragraph 32, for type 3 leases, we think revenue should not be recognized at the commencement of the lease, even if the lessee acquires and consumes more than an insignificant portion of the underlying assets over the lease term. About type 4-1 leases, these contracts include maintenance service. For such leases, we think those maintenance services may not be distinct from the lease component. So, as described in paragraph 33, based on the proposed notion in the revenue recognition project, recognizing one-time revenue would be inappropriate. We think this issue will be further discussed later in sub-issue 1-1. ASBJ staff's alternative are described in paragraphs 37 and 38. Basically, the line between the different races for the lessor in our alternative will be somewhat close to the line between finance leases and operating leases under the existing IS 17. In addition, as mentioned in paragraph 38, if the volatility of the residual asset is low, we think that recognizing one-time revenue would be justified. Discussion point 1. What do you think about ASBJ staff's analysis on the proposed lessor model by the boards and ASBJ staff's alternative on the lessor model? Thank you.
Henry.
I suppose that the first question that I had, maybe that I was looking for a bit of clarity on, was it seems that the concept of the residual asset and the volatility around the residual asset is something that you placed quite a lot of emphasis on in the analysis. I suppose I wasn't still 100% clear just looking at the documents. I mean, it's a good way, it's a different way of looking at it. I don't think we necessarily looked at it that way. But I was wondering what's necessarily the principle behind looking at the residual asset and why the volatility in the residual asset would drive whether or not a lessor would in some cases recognize revenue at point in time versus over time. And I suppose an example that I was thinking of was you had two leases, two different leases. In one case, the lessor provides an asset to the lessee for 10 years and it's got a useful life of 20 years, so he provides it for half of its useful life. And in that case, assume that the residual asset has some volatility, so the type of asset is subject to movements. And you've got another lease where the lessor does almost exactly the same thing. They provide a lease for half of the useful life, 10 years out of 20 years. But in that case, the underlying asset does not have a lot of volatility. I suppose looking at it from my point of view, I think that I was struggling to see how those two transactions are necessarily very different from the lessor's point of view and from the lessee's point of view. And I think if I'm understanding what you are proposing, you would effectively get different accounting in those situations. The one would be overtime recognition and the one would be point in time. So maybe just a clarification would be good.
Don't touch. すいません。パラグラフ16項に書いてあることが一番我々が、気にしているところでありまして、で、その1回上げた利益が、その後からリバースされるということが ないようにするというのが基本的な考え方じゃないかというふうに思っています。で、我々やっぱその一番注目してるのはやっぱりアンダーライングアセット全体、今の例でいくと20年。その20年の間のリスクリワードをやはり見る必要があるんじゃないかということです。で、その今のギャリーさんの説例で、20年の対応年数で10年間のリースと。で、その時にそのレジダルアセットのボラティリティが低ければ、ある意味キャッシュローが最初の10年と後の10年で、切り分けることが最初の段階で見込めるんではないかと。その場合には、まあ、金融商品の、その、構成要素アプローチ、コンポーネントアプローチ、ファイナンシャルインストルメント、コンポーネントオブザファイナンシャルインストルメントと同じように扱ってもいいんじゃないかなと。一方で、その、レジダルアセットのポラリティが非常に高い場合には、10年間経った時に、その、レジダルアセットの価値がどうなっているかわからないと。そうすると、最初の10年間のリースで、アップフロントで利益を上げているのは、10年目になってその残りのもので、ものすごい収益性が悪くなっているかもしれないと。で、そういったリースについては、アップフロントで利益を上げることは、非常にその、操作性も高くなるし、デーマンプロフィットを上げることが反対だということです。もう少し詳しく。
Thank you for that. Just maybe again a clarification question for me then. If the lessor on day one effectively has locked in the cash flows for those 10 years in the example that we've got, so even if the volatility on the residual is going to be high, they've in theory taken that into account when they price the lease on day one. So if they lock in the cash flows for the first 10 years, they know what return they're going to get for that asset for the first 10 years. So, and in, I'm guessing if they're a lessor, they have a pretty good idea what the fair value of their asset is at the point in time when they enter into the lease. So I suppose where I may be still struggling is to understand if I've locked the cash flows in for the first 10 years and I know what the value of my asset is today, why would it be so wrong to say that I know what the profit for that first 10 years is? And then I agree with you, you won't know when you get the lease back at the end of the 10 years what additional cash flows you might be able to get. But I think the model wouldn't recognize any of that revenue. The boards have said that effectively you don't get to record any of that revenue on day one. You would only recognize that revenue when you release the asset, unless, of course, there was a deterioration in the value, in which case you would record an impairment.
あの、今のギャリーさんので、なんだ、その、最初の10年間のキャッシュローが決まってれば、レジダルアセットのボラティリティがあろうがなかろうが、最初の10年間の収益は決まってるじゃないかと。いや、トータルの収益が決まってるのはその通りだと思います。ただ、我々やっぱりその20年のライフタイムで見た場合に、その最初の10年間だけで判断してはいけないんじゃないかと。 この、このペーパーで言っているところの4の、なんだ、27個、パラグラフ27の、この4、2、言ってるような、そのアクティブマーケットがあって、ある程度その、今の例でいくと10年後のデジタルバリューが、まあ、かなり、硬い数字で見えてると。で、そういうものであれば、その、最初の10年間の利益というので、それを確定してもいいんだろうと。ただ、一般的にはこういう、その、アクティブマーケットがあるようなリスクというのは少ないと思うので、基本的には残りの10年間で何が起こるかわからないと。で、そうすると、20年間通算すると、そうすると結局どうなるかわからないと。全体での利益がですね。で、そういったものについて、デーワンゲインを上げることに抵抗があるということです。で、その考え方のもっと根底にあるのは、パラグラフ12ですね。そもそもそういう金融商品じゃなくて、フィクスアセットのようなものをキャッシュフローで切り分けて、最初の10年分だけの利益を上げるっていうこと自体に、まあ、もともとは強い抵抗があるっていうことです。なぜなら、その、アンダーレン、20年のライフタイムのアンダーレングアセット全体で考えた場合には、要は10年間しか貸してないということは、残りの10年間のすごい大きなリスクが残ってるから、そういう意味で我々の考え方っていうのは、やっぱり20年間のライフタイムのアンダーライグアセットのリスクに注目しているアプローチということは言えます。なので、その、10年分の、なんだ、使用権を渡してると。っていう、その、切り分けたアプローチとは少し、もともと違うと。理解してもらいました。
The one more thing I would like to mention is when the lease term is not so long compared with the economic life of the underlying asset, entity may not determine the amount of lease payments directly referring to the decline of underlying assets value. I mean, lessors may consider other factors like market rent or something to determine the level of lease payment. So this may be similar to the cases in real estate leases, which is mentioned in paragraph 20D. On the other hand, we think the longer the lease term is, the clearer the relationship between the amount of lease payments and the decline of underlying assets value becomes. That's the reason why we describe this notion.
Stephen?
I have a lot of sympathy with what you're saying here. I understand your concern. Can I just clarify one thing, though? What you're suggesting for type 3 in your paragraph 27 is to revert to operating lease accounting rather than an alternative that perhaps I might have suggested, which is to stick with the receivable and residual approach, but in some way constrain the amount of profit that's recognized. Because the problem which you identify is the the amount you ascribe to the residual asset determines how much of the carrying value of the asset you derecognize, which then determines how much profit to recognize. So because of that uncertainty of the residual value, you might end up recognizing more profit than you really should have done. And then when I look to revenue recognition, where there's uncertainty, we're proposing to have a constraint, but there's no equivalent constraint within leasing. So if I were to do anything about this, I would do it through some sort of keep the residual receivable approach, because I think that's consistent with the conceptual approach, but in some way constrain. So maybe constrain the residual to an amount that you are reasonably certain or whatever of realizing at the end of the lease, and then calculate the profit. And then there may still be a profit, but at least you'd be constraining that profit to one that was reasonably certain to be realized.
Henry?
Just to add to what Steve has said, I think that is quite important, but we actually did at one stage in the development of the lessor model have a sort of constraint in it for the profit recognition of the lessor along the lines you sort of describe in paragraph 16 of the memo. But a lot of people really struggled with that notion outside when we went and spoke to them. And that's because, I guess, really fundamentally, they say managing residual risk is the essence of our business. And it's not just a number that's sort of plucked out of the air. It's a number they have to price. They have to price that risk. And therefore, when we did have this sort of tentative constraint in the model on profit recognition, when the residual was thought to be more volatile, A, people just couldn't work their way through our words. But I think more fundamentally, they said it basically conflicts with the whole business model of what a lessor is doing. So I think people really struggled with it. And then one of the concerns that I would have about shifting to a model, if you're concerned about residual risk, where you move much more to the operating lease model today, is that you wouldn't be being very responsive to the concerns that people have about current lessor accounting, which fundamentally, if you talk to users, is about the lack of transparency about that residual, because that's the most important thing. It's that residual risk. And today, that's just buried away, in the net book value of the operating lease book, and it's very, there's no transparency around it. And, I've sat in some meetings with users, and, they use all sorts of techniques to try to get to what they believe is the residual risk, the asset risk in the lease portfolio. And they're amazed at just, how far off their estimates are. So, I think what we're trying to do with this lessor model is give greater transparency around the residual asset. And that reflects, in many cases, the lessor sort of business model.
Can I have one thing to...
Yes, Stephen?
Just to add something to Henry's addition to my comment. When there is residual value uncertainty, as Henry says, this is a key issue for the lessors, and they fully take that into account. So the amount they charge for rentals will reflect that. Effectively, they're building in an extra risk premium into the rate that they charge for the lease. So automatically, because of that higher risk premium, the interest rate implicit in that lease is higher. So you discount those lease payments at a higher rate. So it's already reflected in some respects in the amount of revenue recognized because it's being priced into the lease contract itself. And I think that was kind of the way we went with this when we thought about this issue.
Yeah. I think just another very general point, and maybe we're going to come onto this later on in the discussion, is that The feedback that we got from the last exposure draft was very strongly from a lot of people that there needed to be sort of symmetry in the thinking of how the lessee and the lessor model articulated together. And although some board members were quite comfortable about the idea of, let's say, just leaving lessor accounting as it is today and revising the lessee model, a lot of the feedback that we had said that, that really wouldn't be, they didn't feel that was the right way to move forward. And I remember the Big Four being very strong on this because they felt that the standard would be so difficult to explain, to understand, and to maintain if we had lack of symmetry in the rationale between the lessee and the lessor. And kind of it's very interesting the way that you've approached this because, of course, you've started this memo, and in all of the discussions I've had with you, we've always started on the lessor side and then come to the lessee. The boards, of course, started on the lessee and then came to the lessor. So I think it's very refreshing the way you've looked at it. But, you know, one thing that struck me reading your sort of suggestion about the lessor model was to what extent do you think a lessee would be able to sort of divide between different types of leases using the rationale that you have for the lessor, because the lessee isn't really interested in the volatility of the residual asset, of the residual risk. So I think, you know, what the boards believe that they have done with what they've developed is that they've got this sort of consumption principle and that it can be applied by both a lessor and by a lessee. And so that we have a sort of a nice symmetry of thinking, of rationale between the lessee accounting and the lessor accounting, which I think is quite important.
Atsu. No, I told you not to touch it.
Oh,
there he goes again. No, no, no.
Very scared, this machine. Yeah, it is very interesting proposal by Stephen, you know, under this type 3 type of lease, if there is a volatility of the residual asset value, you are saying we should introduce a constraint on this, you know, amount of day one profit as like under the revenue recognition for the variable consideration. But, you know, we're now talking about how to make a constraint for the variable consideration for the revenue by having like an option 1, 2, 3, very complicated, you know, schemes we are now thinking. So if we introduce a similar type of, you know, thought in this lease accounting, we may face same issues, how to set up that, you know, constraint for this, you know, variable future value of residual assets.
Yeah, I mean, it would be a very difficult thing to do. I wasn't suggesting that necessarily we did it. I was suggesting that if we were to do something, that's what I would do rather than revert to operating.
But you've now just convinced them that we should not do it.
And Henry reminded me of all the discussions that we had on this and why we didn't go there.
Atsu 2.
Number 1, please. Steve さん、Henry さん、ありがとうございます。もう少し大きな観点で見ると、Please というのは、レッシーはバランスシートの問題だと思ってます。特にライビリティの問題だと思ってます。で、レッサーの場合には、これは、レベニューなりプロフィットの問題だと思ってまして、なので、もしかしたら、レッサーの方が問題が大きいかもしれないと思ってます。で、その時に我々、非常にあとは、リースの場合は、通常の売却よりも操作性が高いと。 マニプレーションっていうか、オペレーショナリティぐらいかな。なので、そういった意味で、一つのフィクストアセットがあって、そのライフタイムを考えて、残りが半分の期間にリスクが溜まるような会計処理になるのは、取らない方がいいと。それが根底にあります。そういう意味で、スティーブンさんの言われた方法っていうのは、その方法でも我々、私は賛成です。まあ、オペレーティングリース的なものにするにせよ、レジデュアルレシバルアプローチを取った上で、プロフィットにコンストレインをかけることにしても、いずれにせよ D1 プロフィットに対して制約をかけるということなので、そういう意味ではスティーブンさんの発想には賛成です。で、ヘンリーさんの言われたそのこともよくわかるんですけども、で、レッサーのビジネスっていうのはある意味、そのデジタルアセットをコントロールするビジネスだと思います、私も。で、レッサーはみんなそのデジタルアセットよくわかってると言うと思います。ただ、やっぱり物によって非常にポラリティが高いものと低いものがあると思ってまして、ボラリティというか低いものは、ある意味ファイナンスビジネスじゃないかと思います。まあ、その10年間のコンサンプションにプラスイントレストを足したものがリース料の基本になるだろうし、で、ボラリティが高ければ、もっと高いリース料を多分要求すると。スティーブさん言った通りだと思います。そのファイナンス的なビジネスとそうじゃないビジネスはやっぱり分けないといけないんじゃないかなと。それが、会計実務として簡単かどうかというと、あまり評判良くないかもしれない。だけど、今回のやっぱりボードの決定で、一番気になるのはレッシーの切り分けをレッサーの方に持ってきたというのは、それが一番気になる点です。レッサーはレッサーでやはり、しっかり決めないといけないんじゃないかなというのが、まあ、根底にある懸念です。
Yoichi.
Yeah, I would like to respond to what Steve proposed. When preparing this paper, I thought of the exactly the same approach. That approach is very much consistent with the notion in the revenue recognition in the context of addressing the measurement issues but my view is a little bit different from Kogasaka-san, but I'm not sure if such a revenue recognized under your approach reflect the lessor's business. I'm not sure by a constraining the revenue recognized would reflect the lessor's business, I'm not sure. An entity may reliably estimate the residual value on a portfolio basis, I think, but even in those cases, the range of the possible outcome might be wide. So when focusing on the individual lease contract, always recognizing day one profit, will not reflect the Lister's business model. I think they are sometimes providing some certain types of services that is provided by the use of the underlying asset, not the light of use asset, selling the light of use asset. That's my personal opinion.
Okay. Move on to the next issue. Yes.
Okay, so let me move on to the sub-issue 1-1. As described in paragraph 39, under the proposal in the lease project, an entity is required to identify a lease component and a non-lease component and account for them separately, which is different from the proposals in the revenue recognition ED. We are concerned about these proposals in the lease project. One example is shown in paragraph 41. In this case, we think the lessor may not be able to enter into the lease contract without providing the related maintenance service at the same time. So, as described in paragraph 43, we believe the accounting based on the proposals in revenue recognition would be more appropriate, under which the lessor would be required to combine the lease component and maintenance service component if the maintenance service is not distinct. Discussion point 1-1, what do you think about the SBJ staff analysis on the identification of the lease component and the non-lease component?
Gary.
Thank you. I think there's been, obviously, in the revenue project, the boards have re-deliberated how we define distinct components within an arrangement. And I suppose looking at this one, I'm not sure necessarily if I would have got to the same conclusion. I can see how, you know, depending on what all the specific facts and circumstances are, someone might get to that answer. But I suppose in the example that's provided in the paper, I think the question of whether or not that secondary maintenance service is distinct in the context of the contract, I wasn't necessarily convinced that the way that the boards have got to on how we define that second criteria for an item to be distinct, so capable of being distinct and then distinct in the context of the contract. I'm not sure if necessarily we would have got to saying that in that fact pattern that service necessarily would not have been distinct in the context of the contract, because I think what the boards were moving towards with that concept was more the services are, it's an integration service, so it's not as if you've provided something and then you provide a service. It's this asset that I've provided without the integration service, it's actually cannot be used. So I'm not sure if the example was maybe the maintenance is something that has to be done in order for the asset to work on day one, or whether or not it is something that needs to be provided so that the asset continues to work. Because I think, as I said before, that the devil is maybe in the detail, or the difficulties are in the detail. So depending on how you tweak the fact pattern, you might get to a different answer. But I think, at least, I mean, Henry, tell me if you disagree. When we chatted about it maybe before, I think we said in a circumstance where, from a revenue point of view, you would decide that the two performance obligations of the service and the asset were not distinct from a revenue point of view, I think we were struggling to think of an example where, from a lease's point of view, you would conclude that that was actually then a lease with a separate service. You would most likely conclude that that was not a lease transaction, that it was more a single service. I think we see the two as possibly, they should still be symmetrical in most cases.
I think that's very important, Gary, that although it looks like there's a contradiction between the revenue standard and the leasing standard, in the sense that the leasing proposals say you always separate. I think that notion of distinct in revenue is there in the leasing proposals, but it's there in determining whether the contract contains a lease. So if you have a contract whereby, you know, you're assessing whether this thing for, say, some equipment is a lease or not. If that's essentially an asset that's just a mechanism for providing some services, for example, something maybe like some cable box arrangements, then that notion of distinction revenue, I think, comes into play in saying whether or not it's a lease. And I think the board said it isn't a lease, say, you've just got a service contract. So I think there is, you know, similarity between the revenue and the lessor proposals there. It's just, I think that notion of distinct perhaps has come more into play in the guidance about what is a lease. So, and I like Gary, would feel with your example here, I think it would have to be quite an extreme example to conclude that the machine and the maintenance wasn't two performance obligations under revenue. That's my view. I mean, we can talk about that example a little bit more tomorrow if you'd like.
Yeah. So due to the time constraints, let me move on to the issue two. Issue two is about lessee accounting. Described in paragraph 46, we are of the view that a straight line expense pattern is acceptable for certain types of lease for two reasons. The first reason is about characteristics of lease transactions, and the second reason is about the consistency with the dual model for lessee accounting. About the line between two types of leases for lessees, I personally think the proposed line by the boards may be justified based on our understanding described in paragraph 50. And in paragraph 51 to 56, we discuss the issue of symmetry between lessor accounting and lessee accounting. We raise this issue here because under the proposed lease model, we think the lessor accounting and lessee accounting do not necessarily need to be symmetric. The reason is described in paragraph 54 to 56. Rather, as explained in issue one in this paper, lessor accounting should be more consistent with revenue recognition accounting. Therefore, as described in issue one, we are concerned about applying a proposed lessee's line to lessor accounting. But from the viewpoint of focusing on symmetry between lessor accounting and lessee accounting, as described in paragraph 60, we think it would be more appropriate to explore a distinction for the lessor that ensures consistency between lessor accounting and revenue recognition accounting, and then apply that distinction to lessee accounting. Discussion point two, what do you think about SBJ staff's analysis on the proposed lessee model by the boards and SBJ staff's alternative on the lessee model?
I think at least when the staff, we were putting together the proposals for the board and discussing the not just the line, but also whether or not they should be symmetrical between the lessee and the lessor. I mean, we were also contemplating should they be symmetrical, or I think one thing that we were thinking was should we rather defer to looking more to the lessor's business model was one thing that we thought might actually be more appropriate. I think ultimately what we proposed as staff and what the boards went with was that the lessee and lessor accounting should be consistent. And I think some of the main reasons for that was I think we realized that the model was getting quite complicated once we moved to a dual lease approach already. And I think one of the concerns was we didn't want to complicate it further by then creating another way that lessors should try and determine the difference between the two types of leases. So I think some of it was definitely around the understanding that it was already getting quite complicated. I think one of the other main points that swayed us and possibly the board as well was looking to sublease transactions as well, again, tying into that complexity notion. If you had a sublease situation where we'd made the line a different place between lessees and lessors, you might get a situation where the lessee had determined it was a type of lease where they should recognize interest and amortization, but the lessor, from the lessor point of view, you might actually get a straight line type arrangement. So we would have had to possibly propose additional guidance to say, specifically for sublease arrangements, we might have had to write additional guidance to make sure that those two netted off in a way that made sense. So I think, you know, from a, there were other options on the table, and I agree. This is just, you know, obviously this is one of them. This way of looking at it, which is to say, you should start with revenue as the point and then go. But I think for those two reasons, at least from my mind, was the drivers for possibly trying to get symmetrical. And I think the last thing is that I think what was also quite important was we wanted to be symmetrical in the principle as well, in the understanding. And I think we thought that if we were working with a consumption principle, we thought that it did tie together quite neatly to use that same kind of principle then when looking at the lessor side.
Because just to add to what Gary said, I personally think it's quite important to remember that revenue recognition project doesn't just give you the answer for what the lessor accounting should be. Because if it did, we wouldn't be having different views amongst board members in revenue discussions about the treatment of licenses. The point is that I think you've got to decide fundamentally what you think is being transferred from the lessor to the lessee. In other words, what is the nature of the performance obligation? Once you've figured that out, then you can apply the revenue model very easily. But that really is why we're having all of these debates about the lessor accounting model. It's because people have different view about really truly what are the nature of the lessor's performance obligations. And I think one of the big risks that I think we see is that if, from the lessor's point of view, it looks like really it's about, did the lessor transfer the whole of the underlying asset to the lessee? In other words, did they sell the underlying asset? If that's the dividing line between leases that do that and other leases, when this gets looked at from the perspective of the lessee, that will put a lot of pressure on the board's conclusion that the lessee has an obligation that should be recognized. Because I think the people who want to keep leases off the lessee's balance sheet will say, I should only be recognizing an obligation for those leases which are in substance a sale of the underlying asset. And so that's why I think the board's sort of very much steered away from maintaining the line in IS 17 for determining between the sort of the different types of leases. Because I think a lot of people will push back if you had that line and say, why am I putting an asset and liability on my books as a lessee where I'm not acquiring the underlying asset? And so, you know, in the board's model, it's not about acquiring the underlying asset. It's about acquiring the right of use. That's what the lessee is acquiring. That's what the lessor is transferring to the lessee. And then we have look to this consumption principle for doing the sort of the P&L accounting for the lessee. But I think, you know, that would be, in my mind, a big risk about having a classification line that really carries forward that idea from IS 17. I think people would really question, why are you capitalizing, you know, operating leases, frankly.
And that cannot be the hidden agenda here.
まずシンメトリーが必要かどうかということについて、我々やっぱ会計処理を扱っているので、そのシンメトリーである必要はやっぱりないと思ってしまうんですね。普通に物を売る場合に、 物を売るという会計処理と物をパーチェスするという会計処理がそこでシンメトリーという議論は普通はしないと思うんですね。なのでリースも物を貸すということと借りるということは全然違う性質が違って、さっきも言ったレッシーの方はバランスシートに載せるかどうかという問題だし、レッサーの方はレベニューを上げるかという問題なので、会計だけでいけばシンメトリーである必要はないと思ってます。ただ世界中の特にプリペアラーの方々がシンメトリックであるべきだっていうことを多く言うというのは我々もよく知ってます。日本の関係者も基本的にはシンメトリックであってほしいって言います。多分それは同じ一つのプリペアラーの方がレッシーでありレッサーであるということが多分多いから、シンメトリーでないとやっぱり非常に複雑になるということかと思います。ただただそれをただ一番上の概念にしてしまって必ずシンメトリーにするというところから始めてしまうと結果がおかしくなりやしないかなと。で、特にこのパラグラフ55に書いてあるように、55に書いてあるように、今の I-70 みたいにオンとオフがこうシンメトリーになってるんであれば、要はシンメトリーにする意味もあると思うんですけども、ここに書いてあるように今のモデルであれば、この左側の網線見てわかるように、両者でアセットを上げるような会計処理になるわけで、もともとそこにシンメトリーにするっていう必然性がどれくらいあるのかなというのが我々の分析で、なので、今回の結論がちょっとシンメトリーというものを強調しすぎてるんじゃないかなと。我々、さっき神谷さんが言ったように、レッシーの方のディスティンクションは、まあ、比較的受け入れやすいんじゃないかなと思ってます。ただ、イシュー1で言ったように、レッサーの方は非常にこうディスティンクションのところが納得いってなくてですね、そうするとどうしてもシンメトリーにならないので、まあ、こういったような議論を、まあ、した次第です。なので、ヘンリーさんの言うことは非常によく理解できます。あと5分なので、最後に、ページ17の、ジャパニーズプレペラーズのフィードバックをご説明したいと思います。まあ、とはいっても、かなり非常に簡単に終わってしまうんですけども、多分世界中の反応と同じで、プロパティレッサーズのレッサーの方は、まあ、かなり満足してるんですけども、やっぱりエクイプメントレッサーの方は、あまり満足してないというのが一言で言うと、まあ、そういう今のリアクションでして、まあ、多分いろんなところでアウトリーチやってる結果と似てるんではないかなというふうに思います。なんかここに書いてあるようなことで違和感があるようなことがあれば教えていただきたいと
思います。I think I've got the same question in the outreach meeting held in Korea, and I answered. So I just want to repeat the answer here. And the reason why we treat property as a special treatment is because perhaps this is a practical expedient, and this is the best way for us to capture the large population who has the difficulty with this lease accounting. So we thought it is the most efficient way to capture the large possibility and get around the problem. That is one of the reasons why we made a property as special. The second reason is because in most cases, property has a land. Property comes with land. So if the property contains the land, normally we cannot consume land. So that means in most cases, consumption proportion would be smaller. That is the second reason. The third reason is in case of property, we have a different accounting standard, which is IS 40. And therefore, in many cases, lessor can use IS 40. That is the reason why we treated property separately. Of course, we could find other way, but at the moment, we think this is the most efficient way to alleviate the burden of the preparers.
Just to add as well, I think it's very important to realize that our principle isn't property versus non-property. The principle is consumption. And then what we have done is we've said, well, to express our idea most simply in terms of an instruction set, we say, this is what you do if this is property. This is what if it's not property. But, and this is very important, having said this is what you do when there's property, we then say, but you don't do this if these conditions are met, so as in paragraph 1A. And the point behind that, of those, if you like, exceptions to this is what you do for all property, is to get you closer back to the principle. So we have a principle, which, and then we have decided to write the standard by saying most property will be like this, most equipment will be like this, but we have except for, and those exceptions are precisely to try and get, you know, to get you back to the principle. And I think it's a bit unfortunate because I think people have seen that we are, you know, we're getting criticized that the standard is based on the form of the asset. And I don't think that's at all what the board intended. They had very much clear idea that the principle was based on consumption. It just so happens that many property leases will have little consumption and many equipment leases will have more than insignificant consumption. So we decided to be practical in the way that we wrote the standard.
This is very typical of what happens in standard setting, as you know. First of all, you have to start out with a beautiful conceptual system. Then people tell you this is not workable and we need exceptions and expediencies. So you come up with exceptions and expediencies, and then they start attacking you for not being consistent. And that's a